Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. Today's session, Thinking Again About Genesis, Part 1, A Relational Perspective. A Bible study presented in the Fireside Room by Terence Fredheim. Disc number FRT-2005-02. Let's listen in.
It's actually from the manuscript, but it's a couple of pages from my book on God and the World in the Old Testament that's published by Abingdon now. And this will serve us both for today and tomorrow. So if you can remember to bring this back tomorrow, we'll take a closer look at it. There are some new people here, so I should say who I am and what we're about. I'm Terry Fredheim. I teach Old Testament at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And we're working with Old Testament materials primarily on creation. And today and tomorrow, I want to take another look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, not so neatly separated, but think together about those texts relationally. Okay, yesterday we talked about relationship. What does it mean to talk about creation relationally? And that's our agenda today and tomorrow. How do you start talking about Genesis 1 and 2? I mean, there are, in the history of biblical interpretation, there are a few texts, if any, that have been talked about more than these two chapters. And from every conceivable viewpoint, and controversies still erupt. You go to school board meetings in Kansas, and they're talking about Genesis 1 and 2. And it's continuing, ambiguous text, uncertain text, a text that has gaps in it, that opens itself up to varying interpretations. And there are a number of dimensions of these texts that I think at the present time at least are undecidable. They mean this, they mean this. And if you look at the very first verses in Genesis 1, you should have a footnote which gives you three different options for translation. And the option that you choose is going to affect everything that you say on what follows. At least they could have started the Bible with clear statement. Maybe it was clear to them, but it's not clear to us. But over the years, all sorts of interpretations, of course, have arisen. But in modern times, there have been various insights, data that are emerging that have complicated our look at these texts. And I want to just briefly mention these. We could spend a lot of time on each. Archaeological discoveries. I mean, the headlines 150 years ago were creation stories discovered in the Middle East. Flood stories discovered in the Middle East. Very similar to the biblical stories that we have about creation and the flood. And all of a sudden, how is what we have in the Bible related to these stories that were obviously circulating out and about the Middle East before there ever was a Bible? How is the biblical material related to those Mesopotamian primarily stories? The direct dependence, some indirect dependence, some combination thereof. We know that Abraham came from Mesopotamia. You bring these stories with them and baptize them along the way. Who knows? But that's an issue. Archaeological discoveries has complicated our work. Another is scientific discovery. Astronomy, physics, biology, cultural anthropology, you name it. How old is the Earth? How and when did life appear, human and non-human? Clearly, the opening chapters of Genesis are interested in what we would call pre-scientific matters. They're interested not just in who created the world, but in how the world was created. And so they do talk about classifications of plants and classifications of animals, and the ordering of creative events makes certain sense in terms of the observations made of the world generally in that time and that place. How do these texts, things like the 24-hour days, there was evening, there was morning, How do those realities in the text relate to these scientific discoveries? That's a big issue, of course. There are also more sort of social justice issues that have arisen in the last century or so. There are the environmental issues that have been raised. If the text tells you, have dominion over the animals, have dominion over the creatures, and the text tells you to subdue the earth, isn't that license for exploitation? Huh? Well, it has been so interpreted for years. That we as human beings are free to do whatever we want to do with the environment, because the text, Genesis 1, tells us to do it. That creates a problem. And of course, pages, manuals have been written trying to come to terms with the environmental issues that are raised by these creation texts. Another social justice issues has to do with feminist issues, the women's movement. When it says in Genesis 3:16, the man shall rule over you, Eve, okay, there you are. Sounds to me like a prescription for the rest of our days. Well, what are you going to do with it? You got a text. Anyway, the literature insights into the type of literature that we have. And what kind of literature is this? Is this historical narrative? You know, sort of if you had your camcorder there, you would have picked it all up, and it would look just like it's like these texts portray it. Is it a story of the past? And the Israelites were interested in telling how things were at the beginning, and they weren't interested in history in our sense of the term, but at least a story of the past. Or, like some think, was it simply, they're not interested in the past in any way, shape, or form. It's just simply telling it like it is with regard to life in every time and place, with regard to creation, with regard to sin, and so forth. And then there are these two chapters that the Bible opens up with. You get this nice, rhythmic, almost doxological, seven-day sequence of the world being brought into being by God on the one hand, and then you get into chapter 2, and you get God down there in the dirt, you know, making human beings, and like a surgeon taking the rib out of the, or whatever, out of the man and creating woman. They long suggested that, well, those two chapters can't have originated in the same mind. Must be two different authors going on here. And so commonly you get chapter 1, a priestly author, sort of a late, a portrayal of creation in Israel, and you get chapter 2, sort of an early, more naive, or primitive perspective on creation. And then somewhere, it's been very common to sort of contrast Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 over the last 100 plus years. You get these images of God, and we'll come to them in just a minute, in Genesis 1 that just seem to stand over against the images in Genesis 2. How do you relate these two pictures of creation? Well, if they're now increasingly, whatever the origins of these two chapters was, they are now brought together by an editor or a redactor, set side by side, and one of the responsibilities we have as contemporary interpreters is to interpret them together and not simply separately. You know, there's one understanding of creation here, another here. We need to bring these understandings together and see how they interact with one another, how they qualify one another, and hopefully greater insight might be gained. The only perspective, really, that we can be certain about are these two chapters together. We don't know for certain what things look like along the way. We've got some ideas, but... there are these various areas of study, and a lot could be said there, but where I want to zero in on are some theological matters this morning, particularly with regard to Genesis 1. And let me start with the phrase, the image of God. And Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, will shape our thinking about these texts this morning. Genesis 1:26, and God said, let us make, we'll come back to us, Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So, verse 27, God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, verse 28, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. A profound text, but not easy to understand. In the history of the study of what the image of God is all about, and the volumes would fill this room, been almost exclusive attention given to what image means and what likeness means, but relatively little attention to what God means. And the God of this phrase, image of God, has sort of been taken for granted. And what I want to claim is that the content that we give to the word God in this context is going to have a lot to say about how we interpret these texts and how we take away words from this text with regard to such matters as care for the environment. I want to claim that the word God in this text at this point, in this chapter, has fundamentally to do with creative activity. That's what God's about here in this chapter. God's creative activity. So the human vocation to be in God's image is to be modeled on the creative work of God. On the creative work of God. Now, one of the interesting things to do is to suggest some images of God that aren't here. Well, one of the images of God that is not here, in my opinion, is that there's not a militaristic image of God. Once in a while, you get some folks who think that God is subduing chaos and acting like a military leader, but that's pretty rare, actually. It's more common in other ancient Near Eastern material. You'll find it a little bit in the Psalm 74, for example. But generally speaking, the militaristic perspective of God subduing chaos is really way in the background of this text, I think. And certainly, there's no indication of a conflict motif, I think, in the opening verses of Genesis. Most agree with that. So the military images seem not to be present. Monarchical images. God is a king. People are more interested in the royal images for God that might emerge here, particularly in the connection with have dominion. That's to say, if human beings are to have dominion, is that somehow not related to God who has dominion, or God who exercises royal power in this particular perspective? I think that there are some royal materials that have informed the opening chapters of Genesis, and we'll come back to have dominion in just a moment, but I think that this text is finally anti-monarchical. Anti-monarchical. And I'll come back to that. A third possible way into this text is that it's patriarchal, that the images of God that are presented here are patriarchal. But I think it is very striking, particularly when you get into this text that we just read, is that male and female are created in the image of God, and there is no hierarchical understandings of their relationship in this text at all. Now, if you have a God that you believe is portrayed in this text in terms of overwhelming power, absolute control over things, sort of independent, unilateral activity of bringing the world into being, that's the God you see here, you're in trouble. Why? Because you've been created in the image of that God. You've been created in the image of that God, and properly, you should understand your role as an image of that God in comparable terms of power over, absolute control, independence, by definition, if that's the God you have here in this text, that's the God you see here in this text, the natural world then becomes available for you for manipulation and exploitation. I think a question like this would seem to me to be pertinent. Hasn't the human tendency over the years to dominate the environment been an effort, whether recognized or not, to act in the image of this dominating God of Genesis? I mean, if the creatures of Genesis 1 are understood to be but passive putty in the hands of God, then doesn't that invite a comparable treatment of the creatures on the part of those of us who are made and created in the image of God? If you're interested in an environment and you promote an imaging of God in this chapter that is filled with images of power and domination, then you're working against yourself. On the other hand, if God is imaged more as a sharer of power in these accounts, then it seems to me the way in which we who are created in the image of God understand our role is to be shaped by that model. And one of the things that we need to do now then is to take a look at how might we think of God in this opening chapter of Genesis, first chapter today, second chapter tomorrow. How might we think of this God more in relational terms as one who shares power and not simply one who exercises power and dominates? If you look at the very first words now to the newly created human beings, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion, subdue the earth. If you think about these words now in terms of creativity, creative word indeed, and I was going to read a couple of sentences from a little book by John McQuarrie, who's a British systematician. He says, in reading Genesis 1, it's not so much an exercise of power on God's part that you see here in Genesis 1, but an exercise of love and generosity, of imagination and creativity, an act of self-limitation. That's to say, sort of God moves over and makes room for others. An act of self-limitation, even of self-humiliation on God's part. God's love and generosity leads him to share existence with the creatures. God puts himself into the creation. God commits himself to it, takes responsibility for it, though at the same time, he commits a share of the responsibility to the creatures. That's John McQuarrie. I think an interesting language. But in this understanding, God is creative, one, love, generosity, creativity, imagination. God chooses not to be the only one with creative power, with creative capacity. God certainly takes the initiative. I don't want to set that aside at all. God takes the initiative in creation. God is the one who distributes power to the newly created human beings. God is one who invites participation in the use of this power, fruitful, multiply, have dominion, subdue the earth. But having done so, having made this power-sharing move, I mean, what does it mean, as we talked yesterday, what does it mean for the very first words of God to the newly created being, human being, very first words is to share power? What's that mean? That's got to be of central importance in what we think about here. God is a power-sharing God, and God will be faithful in this way of relating to the world. I mean, God God is not going to say somehow, because God's faithful, God's committed to the world. Things aren't going so well down there in the earth. I think tomorrow I'm going to suspend all these relationships for just 24 hours and get a few things done, and then I'll give it back to them. I think that sometimes the way in which we think about this God is that God is sort of capable of suspending the world and the way in which it works, suspending the system, fixing things a little bit, and then sort of. But if God's committed to the world, this is a faithful God who's committed to the way in which God has created the world and relates to it. God's not going to be suspending the system in the interest of sort of fixing things a little bit. God's going to have to choose a different way, and God does choose a different way. Now, a couple of words about these phrases: be fruitful, multiply, have dominion, subdue the earth. And we'll get to the sheep in just a sec here. Be fruitful and multiply, that's not attended to very much, actually, on the part of scholarly work here. But if God's essential image is his creative power, then our likeness to God, at least in significant part, consists of our procreative capacities. And so if you have, if you look at the very first words in Genesis 4:1, of the life on the far side of the garden, and look at what Eve says when she gives birth to their first child. And now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced. Well, that could just as well be translated created. Kana, they're interested in a play on Cain. So Kana is used in Genesis 14, they're translated created and so forth. So you could have Eve, in fact, saying, I've created a man with the help of the Lord. Isn't that interesting language? Sort of right out of the chute, you get a new human being in the world, and the language of creation is used to talk about what Eve is about. Then if you move to chapter 5, interesting how this language continues. Verse 3, chapter 5. When Adam had lived 130 years, and he became the father of a son, in his likeness according to his image, and named him Seth. You get God creating human beings in his likeness after his image. Now you get Adam creating new human beings in his likeness after his image. And so human beings are given the responsibility of bringing into being ever new images of God. And so you have, important creative dimension of human responsibility that's brought to the fore with that language, be fruitful and multiply. Have dominion. Another word that's used here, a lot could be said, but I think that this word, have dominion, one were to track it, do a little word study in various Old Testament texts, Ezekiel 34, 1-4, for example, or Psalm 72, what we'd find is that this verb, rada, have dominion, has basically the sense of caregiving, even nurturing. Certainly not exploitation. It's interesting, the killing of the animals for food is permitted only when you get to chapter 9. In chapter 1 of Genesis, verses 29 and 30, only plants, and in that culture, plants were not considered to be living creatures, only plants are given for food. And Noah is interesting. Exemplar here of how to take care of the animal world. When the flood threatens, he brings them all into the ark. A third phrase has to do with subdue the earth, and I want to lift this one up a little bit more. Subdue the earth. Now, the language of subdue is negatively used in a number of Old Testament texts, but this is the only text where it's used with reference to non-human creatures to subdue the earth. And what does subdue mean here? I think I like the phrase to bring order out of disorder. Bring order out of disorder. On your sheet, number 3, Number five. God creates by bringing order to that which is already exists. For example, the earth in chapter 1, 2, and chapter 1, 9. In chapter 1, verse 9, interesting how God talks about the earth here. The earth is present already in verse 2. The chapter begins with the earth already there. Depends a little bit on how you translate that, but already there in verse 2. But notice in verse 9 what God does as a creative act. It is, And God said, this is 1:9, let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place and let the dry land appear. The earth's already there. And the creative act is ordering. You let the dry land appear. So it sort of emerges out of the water, if you will. Well, the human beings are given a responsibility relative to the earth that's in continuity with God's creative act in verse 9, to subdue the earth, to continue to bring order out of disorder. That seems to be the basic force of it. And now, if the earth still needs to be ordered, subdued, if there's still disorder there, that makes clear, it seems to me, that when God says it's good, it's very good, means it's not perfect. Still got work to do out here, folks. Continue to bring order out of disorder. There is further attention needed here, further development with regard to the creative order. In other words, there's a certain open-endedness. There's a certain disorder that's a part of the world that God creates. Leaves room then for further developments on as the history of nature proceeds, as the history of human beings' relationship to nature proceeds. So the development in with respect to the earth, change with respect to the earth, are integral to what God intends. God gives human beings responsibility to bring order out of disorder. So God leaves something for people to do, if you will. So God creates a paradise, but that garden is not a static place. There's some open-endedness here. There's a dynamic situation in which the future is open to a number of possibilities, and in which creaturely activity is crucial in terms of the proper becoming of the creation. Now, let me come to the sheet again, if you will, and take a look at a couple of these images in light of what we have said. Generally speaking, the sheet has to do with the modes of creation and the tendency on the part of a sort of a traditional approach to these texts is to zero in on number one. God creates by means of the word. Or perhaps zero in as well on number six. God creates creatures out of nothing. And let that be sufficient statement about God's creative activity. The more I look at these texts, the more variety I see in terms of the way in which God brings the world into being. Now, if you take the speaking, I think that's an important dimension. God, by means of the word, number one. Number two, by means of the word. So number one would be, let there be light, and there was light. Okay. Number two, God creates by means of the word, followed by deeds of separation and other creative actions. And so it's insufficient to simply say, let there be light, and there was light. God goes on to do something, and God separated the light from the darkness. Okay? And so you get that rhythm throughout the chapter on God speaking and God doing. Speaking is insufficient. But then zero in on number three, if we can here for a moment. And It's intriguing to me. What God speaks with others and invites their participation in the creative process. Now let's take a look at a couple verses which get us there. Look at, again, chapter 1 and verse 11. And God said, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on the earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation. Who's the subject of creation? The earth is. God, and it's God says, let the earth bring forth, That means doesn't function as a command. It leaves room for creaturely response. Let the earth bring forth. And then drop down to verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures. Now here it goes on to say in verse 21, God created the great sea monsters. But that's not to suggest that somehow God having commanded the waters, that the waters do not participate in the creative activity, just as the earth does back in verses 11 and 12. Or look at verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind. One more time to the earth. And so here you get, it's a God speaking to that which is already created and inviting the creature to participate in still further creations. So that God chooses not to do all the creating all by God's self. God involves the creature. This is what you might say, this is sort of mediated creative activity on God's part rather than immediate creative activity. Creation takes place sort of from within rather than being imposed from without. And if you take the idea of God speaking to a creature, and then you have the response of the creature, as you do in particularly evident in 1, 11, 12, then that you've got time between the giving permission and the response of the creature in bringing forth. So that gives you a sense in the chapter more of process than punctiliar event. In terms of how the creature come into being. Maybe I can do that tomorrow. It's very, very interesting to me that the creation comes into being over time. However you interpret 7 days, it comes into being over time. And the St. Augustine couldn't stand it. He said, God is all powerful, and so God must have created the universe instantaneously. But the text doesn't want to go there. The text wants to say the creation, God takes time to create. God takes time to create. And so that creation here is something that comes into being over time. It's more process oriented than it is punctiliar event. Creation takes time, one of the points in this text. Now, finally, today, let's look at 126. And then we'll open it up here. Let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness. A few comments about the us and the importance of this. Notice the parallel between let the earth bring forth, let the waters bring forth. I get all these verses on that sheet now that you have. One 11 and 126 are the most prominent one, but the 11, 20, 24, all of these calling upon the creatures to participate in the creative process. And now that's you come finally to this let us, and who's the us? Scholarly work on this is moving remarkably to a consensus here. There are a few people who are not takers of this interpretation, which I give you here, that this has reference to divine beings, we might call them angels today, and semi-divine beings in the heavenly realm. In the Old Testament, is referred to as the divine council or the divine assembly. Creatures in the heavenly sphere with whom God consults, with whom God acts with regard to a whole variety of divine actions on the earth. You see it again, operative, say, in the opening chapters of the book of Job. So here, I like to think of God here as a consultant. Can you move with that imaging, Rod? Imagine a room full of board members or whatever, church council people. Let us create humankind. Let us do it. Huh? What does it mean for God to share the responsibility with regard to the creation of humankind? What does it mean for God to say, I'm not going to do this all by myself. I'm going to share this responsibility because I know what's coming here. No. But the creation of humanity is thus it's the result of a dialogical act. That's really key. Creation of humanity is the result of a dialogical act. It's the result of an inner divine communication. It's a mutuality in the creation of human beings. And this has a tremendous amount of tremendous implications for how one views the stature of the human being that made in the image of a God who exercises mutuality, who engages in consultation, engages in conversation with regard to the next stage of the creation. So, now again, to reiterate what we were saying yesterday, to think about such mutuality, God and the let us, doesn't imply equality of God and the divine beings. God's God and they're not, like not unlike the situation with us. But the text here, it want to say, I think, that this relationship between God and the divine council is of such a nature that you get genuine mutual interaction, you get interdependence. God chooses to relate to others in the act of creation. God again takes the initiative. God extends the invitation to the divine council, certainly. But they have a genuine role to play. And so that the product of their work, finally, is, it's interesting in the text, that we are notice that language in 126. That's the statement of approval or disapproval, one or the other. Notice that language, let us make humankind in our image. And so human beings are created not simply in the image of God, we're also created in the image of the divine beings with whom God worked in the creating of human beings. And so you get then that our means that we're created in the image of all that are involved in the creation of humankind. So, what do we have here? God chooses not to create unilaterally in every respect or in isolation. God will share the creative process with others, whether it be the earth or the waters or the divine council. And human beings then, created in the image of God, are uniquely and specifically said to be the result of this inner divine consultation. And you get then a relationship with a mutuality within the divine realm, which is implicitly extended to those of us who are created in that image. We are led to expect, though, that God will involve us in the creative process. That's what the text leads us to. in some way. Huh? And this engagement of the human being in the creative process then follows in chapter 2:18, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion, subdue the earth, participation in the ongoing creative process of a creation that is not perfect at the beginning, that's not fully developed at the beginning, but is on the move. And so, in effect, we have work to do, and we're given work to do. And that's, maybe that's enough now. Let's just open it up for conversation. Questions? Yes, sir.
You've defined image in some ways. Can you further define image?
Yeah, well, I've purposely stayed away from that language because of all the attention that's been given already, and tried to focus our attention on God. And because I think there's been insufficient attention given to the sort of content of the word God in that phrase. I think without going into too much detail here, but basically, the word likeness qualifies image in some way. That's to say, so that we're not to think that human beings are sort of a perfect replica of the divine, or thinking here now of God and the other divine beings. But likeness goes on to talk about, hey, we're like. That also means we're unlike. So that there's a significant differentiation that's also recognized in this. Image probably has two basic forces. We're created in the image of God, and we're created to be the image of God. We're created in the image of God, and we're created to be the image of God in the world. I've been stressing here that we're created to be in the image of God. That's who God is and what God is about in these texts models what we are to be in the life to which we are called. Now, if we were to go back, created in the image of God, what kind of detail might one work with there? There's a long history of people saying, well, it's human reason, it's human emotion, it's the spirit, human spirit. These are the points at which there is a significant likeness to God. Actually, the direction of scholarship these days is moving away from finding something particular within the human which is created in the image of God, but thinking of the human as a whole, including the body, as created in the image of God. In the Old Testament, God all the time is taking bodily form and appearing among human beings, Abraham at his tent door in Genesis 18, for example. And so Bonhoeffer's also got, I don't know if I can find that here, but got a wonderful image. We are a body. I mean, we can't separate ourselves from the body. We can't think of ourselves finally apart from bodily existence. We speak of the resurrection of the body. And so people, scholars increasingly think of as the image of God as including all of who we are and not just some part of it. That's a beginning. I don't know if you want to push me or not, but please do. Okay. Yes, please.
Tell me.
By the way, I cannot see hands upstairs, okay? So if you want to get into the conversation, you know, you'll just have to speak up, okay? Okay, yeah, please.
Something you said about when God made room in himself to share power with the creative power with human beings is also, I think, then sharing a kind of mutual responsibility for what had been created.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, what you're just saying about kind of the dialogic reality, the only way to discover that responsibility and to live it is in dialogue, is with another or with God. And you know.
Yep, yeah. I think that to be in continuing dialogue with God about the tasks to which we have been given, is crucial to what we are to be about in the world. But I think that, to come back to the image, one of the ways in which it's been suggested that the image works is that it has, and it connects with the idea of dialogue, that human beings have a unique capacity to come into a communicating relationship with God. That's another way of thinking about that. And so that communicating relationship, the dialogical relationship that will continue, should continue in this context, seems to me to be crucial. It's who human beings are and what they're called to do. Yes, please.
You just said something that intrigues me after listening to your comments about the tasks we have been given. Mm-hmm. Assumes that God has given us our tasks. And if we're in a mutually creating mm-hmm. mode, aren't we choosing our tasks?
Yes, yes. I think yes and no. That's a nice, very nice question. I think initially, in the Genesis text wants to say, God set a basic agenda. Be fruitful, multiply, so forth. God sets that agenda. But there's ongoing dialogue, an ongoing communicating relationship between God, and that's going to take, that's going to mean change and development with regard to new vistas, new agendas, new ways of working with the world. We saw yesterday in our thinking about relationship that, remember, God has so entered into relationships that God is not the only one who has something important to say. We have something important to say within this relationship, and so that could be about the business of, say, establishing agenda, the sort of new responsibilities that make themselves apparent at any particular time and place. I think that's important. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, please.
It seems that as soon as creation happens, that there's relationship. So as soon as God says, let there be light, then he's in relationship with his creation. And he says, we're going to do something else now. I mean, it's almost like the dialogue with Moses, in a way, that the creation influences, that's what you mean by process, I assume.
The words, let's just illustrate again, the word to the earth, say, in verse 11, you get sort of let them bring forth, the earth bring forth. Then you get to the receptor of that word, mm-hmm. Who works with that word, so that then you haven't got creation as punctiliary event, you've got a time frame, you've got a process over the course of which there can be further, and not with human beings at least, there can be further consultation and dialogue with regard to the shape of the creation. But did you?
I had a second question or point, which was had to do with the relationship between the three points in the text that you drew out, which was the one, God says, in the very beginning, let us make, so us, so there's the plural, the dialogue. And then when Eve refers to creating man, she says, I, with the help of, and then with Adam, it's even, in a way, more abstract from relational, at least the way this text says it's,
it's the narrative.
He became the father of, in the likeness of, so forth, and I'm just wondering if, how would you interpret that progression?
That's interesting.
My thought is that you get the model of God as a biologic, creative, plural, shared power sharing.
Yeah.
And then what you get is, as you get the progression away from the garden, for example, is a more emergence of a kind of narcissistic.
Interesting. I'd not thought of that. Thank you very much. That has been suggested for Eve, that's somewhat more self-oriented. But I've not heard that suggested with regard to the narrator's comment in chapter 5, verse 3. It is because it is the narrator,
right?
And so it's a male narrator, I suppose.
It removes it from Adam as being an agent in the process, in a sense. And so, I don't know, it's just a
structure. Yeah, it's a bare statement of what, in fact, happens here, rather than an engagement in process. That's right. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes?
Well, on the same text, I wonder at that point whether the fact that Eve is your responsibility for kind of a bad kid. And Adam is the one who passes on a likeness to the line that will survive, if there's anything in that. And also whether Eve saying, I will bring forth, is using God's language in a certain way that Adam is not. To bring, you know, in pain and bring forth children and
yeah.
That kind of, that's a
right.
tie-in.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, when I suggested that about some self-orientation with regard to the Eve statement, always it seems to me that the sort of the feminist question needs to enter the room. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has, is that particular observation mm-hmm. due to the fact that you have a woman who's responding to the situation here, and are we suspicious then, overly suspicious of mm-hmm. of what she has to say? Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, an important word to get into the conversation for sure. Yeah. Did you, was that where you were going, Dorothy?
Yeah, but, no, I mean, what do you think of this idea that, that's part of it, yes, that the narrator, that the story gives Eve a responsibility for saying, I made this child, you know, but yeah. then that's the bad child.
Yeah.
While Adam,
oh, the bad, yeah.
who passes on the image and likeness to the surviving line.
So if you look back up in 425, Eve is responsible for that. As well,
right?
Sure she is.
Yeah.
No, but she
yeah.
claims that she verbalizes it
oh. yeah.
as well. You have to read the entire passage.
Yeah. Yeah. For God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel because Cain killed him. That one, that's what you have reference to.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have some recognition there, continued recognition on the part of Eve with respect to a son that's not Cain-like, if you will.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
In Genesis 2, we get to the tree of good
yep.
and evil. Are you going to talk about that tomorrow? Or?
Yeah, well, I'm going to focus somewhat more on the second chapter tomorrow. But why don't you state your question and get it in this context?
God created both good and evil.
Well, that's a... got a couple of key questions here. One is, it's a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Does that mean that God created evil? Okay. But a second question is, what's the word evil entail here? It could be translated the tree of the knowledge of good and bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll get this word ra'ah, Hebrew word ra'ah in the Old Testament. It has a wide range of meanings, everything from some real wickedness and evil on the one hand. But on the other hand, you sort of you hit your finger with a hammer, and you heard it, and that's evil. I mean, that's the word. If Adam and Eve had fallen from the apple tree and broke their arm, it would have hurt prior to sin. Okay, I mean, pain was a part of the
yeah.
a part of the world that God created, how can I state this further at this point that might be helpful. It states in chapter 3, verse 22, that God has knowledge of good and evil. And so what might that mean? Does that mean that God recognizes that reality in the world? God anticipates that reality in the world? What might that mean? But I think it's not correct to say, I think that goes too far to say, that God created evil.
It's like he didn't eliminate a bad
potential. It certainly didn't, we'll talk about this a little bit on Friday, that God created a world which is not free of risk.
Yeah.
And that, in other words, the bad could be regularly happening to human beings, even if sin had not entered into the life of the world.
Is that not that sharing of responsibility and yes. power that he gives us?
Yeah, I think so that we suffer the effects of our own deeds, you mean? Is that
or that we that he isn't this super higher being, but he puts us in relationship to share the power and responsibility of weighing those two, of keeping them in balance.
I think, I think one would want to sort of make a basic claim about the transcendence of God here. I don't know if that's what you meant by a super higher human being.
I'm just saying that he's not the only one that knows everything, that he's giving us the potential and the possibility to view the world or ourselves such as he does.
That's I think there's probably a difference between God and human beings with respect to the range of knowledge.
Oh, absolutely.
But
to follow that point, I think I've got exactly what you're talking about, because unless we are free to choose, unless the choice is there, then there is no value to choosing to do good, to follow God's commands, to do those things. So in that act of power sharing and making room for human beings and in giving human beings choice, there has to be then the room for us
to blow it.
Yeah. Because there's no value, there's no redemption in not blowing it.
That's helpful. Does that connect with what you
were saying? Right, I'm just saying, if only God knows good and evil or bad and good, and we don't have any recognition or concept of that, then what we do has no, we don't understand it. We don't know what we're doing.
Human beings are given a genuine choice here.
Right.
Yeah, and that's important. Yeah.
Are there any examples in Scripture where God addresses this heavenly council and says, let us do this, and that, whatever? And the heavenly council responds, God, that's what we hired you to do.
Yes, I mean, if you go to the boardroom image here, that would work, wouldn't it? I don't know of any place where you get that kind of interaction between God and the divine council where you would get that kind of comeback. You got thinking of anything there?
I mean it partially facetiously, if you can believe that. But in some sense, it becomes a kind of original sin by saying that, God, that's your job. I mean, it's sort of like if you start to sentence, if I were God, I would. Or if there is a God, why doesn't he blank? You wind up with definitions of God like you started with, all powerful, all this, all that. It degenerates to that human design image of God. Uh-huh. And so, I guess,
refusing your status as creature, as advocating responsibility.
It's God's job. It's God's job to stop war, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. That's it. That's very intriguing. I think it's helpful to think about, is there a way, commonly the way in which we think about sin in the life of the world is we think about something active, something we do, something we act against, whatever. What you're suggesting here is that it may be that sin could be, also needs to be thought of in terms of abdicating responsibility.
Relational abdication.
Yeah. Sort of a passivity in relationship to the life of the world that is a failure with respect to living in the image of God. That's helpful, very helpful. Yes, they're village philosopher.
You can call him Marv, Dr. Fred Hyde. I was really intrigued, the whole idea that it takes God time to create. And that says something about God. But I also note that at the end of the week, God has expended God's self in some ways, physically, emotionally, whatever, so that God requires...
Oh my gosh!
Or a coffee break.
He times his questions.
He does it.
Exactly yesterday.
I don't deserve the last word.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about that tomorrow. We're moving into the second creation story, and this is sort of a fulcrum text between the first story and the second story, is that striking that the language of finishing and all occurs in the opening chapter verses of chapter 2. God finished the creation on the seventh day. God rests. Is it that God's sort of all tired out? And I've done enough. I'm going to give the rest of it for you to finish, to accomplish. Or is it that, might it be this, that God simply takes a moment, a day, to enjoy, to take in what has been created, and but a second piece of that is also important. Not only to let the creation be what it was created to be. Just let it be. I mean, so God sort of backs off, huh?
Sets an example.
Lets it be. Excuse me?
Sets an example.
Yeah, there you, yeah, certainly that. The directive to observe the Sabbath day is not present here, but it's certainly implicit in terms of the model, a model for human beings. But to let the creation be, to enjoy the creation, those dimensions of that text seem to me to be particularly prominent. But we want to come back tomorrow to chapter 2 and continue this conversation. Thank you very much.